Welcome. You're listening to The Green Majority. I'm your host, Darren Kaster. I am joined in studio today as well by Kevin Farmer, and we have Lisa Mazzalina joining us a little bit later as well. We're going to start the show today with an interview. We have Beverly Fernandez, who's going to be talking to us in just a moment with a website called Stop the Great Lakes Nuclear Dump. We're going to find out all about what is going on there. Just as a preview, though, however, I'd like to say good morning. Kevin, how are you doing?
Hi, Darren.
Preview. The preview wasn't of Kevin's good morning. The preview is actually is that, as I mentioned last week, we're going to be doing a bit of a year-in-review show today. So after we have an opportunity to speak to Beverly, we're going to go to a music break, and then we'll come back and spend most of the rest of the show tossing around some of the things that happened in the past year, and maybe some of the things, some predictions of what we can look forward to. I know I like playing the prediction game, and Kevin's likes playing that as well. So we'll talk about maybe what we think is going to happen. With that, we've got a whole bunch of stuff we want to cover on that. There's certainly been an active year this year. But before we get to that, I understand that I do have Beverly on the line. So Beverly, are you there?
Yes, good morning.
We had some success with local activism here in Canada this year. One of the things we'll be talking about a bit later was the success of the stopping of the Melancton mega quarry, which was attached to events, big events in Toronto like Soupstock and that sort of thing. Certainly hasn't been a terrible year for activism. So why don't you start there and just tell us exactly what is the proposal that that is being planned, that's in progress right now, and what exactly is your opposition to it?
Okay. Ontario Power Generation plans to bury radioactive nuclear waste right beside Lake Huron in a deep geological repository. So this deep geological repository will extend to approximately 400 meters from Lake Huron, and this will be located on the Bruce Nuclear Power Plant site. So I think it's relevant if I explain a little bit about what a DGR is, a deep geological repository. You will drill down to a depth of 680 meters, and it's a huge hole in the ground with tunnels and an emplacement room, and these emplacement rooms will be 250 meters in length and 8 meters by 7 meters in diameter. So to put this in perspective, these rooms are about the size of an average two-story house pushed down a huge tunnel. And what will be buried there is radioactive nuclear waste. And our organization feels that burying nuclear waste 400 meters from Lake Huron is a huge concern. The Great Lakes represent 21% of the world's fresh water. 40 million people use the water of the Great Lakes for their drinking water, and we simply cannot place this precious resource at risk.
All right. Now, one of the things that I saw off your website was that you have a list of reasons to be concerned, which I think was the best place to start. I'm going to take them slightly out of the order in which you've presented them, but the fifth one down there, which I think is relevant just to the comment you just made there, was about the 40 million people that use the Great Lakes for fresh water. As you said, it's approximately the Great Lakes is approximately 21% of the surface fresh water in the world, still a very, very significant of total fresh water in the world. So the first thing that jumped at me there was some people may be aware of the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement of 1978, which is an agreement between Canada and the U.S. to have joint ownership and thereby joint responsibility and protection of the Great Lakes systems. My question to you, which I didn't relevant to that I didn't see addressed on the website, maybe I just missed it, was any expression of concern from the American government or American citizens on this issue?
Well, yes, this process is in the environmental assessment phase right now, and it is open for public comment. So there are several environmental groups that have expressed concern by way of this public comment period, and a number of individuals from the U.S. that have expressed concern as well. That is pretty much where it stands right now.
Do you happen to know if this is something that would have to get presidential or you know, Senate, like government authorization from the Americans, or does this not fall within that water quality agreement?
The way the process is set up right now in Canada, that approval is not necessary.
Okay. So even though they could be affected, it doesn't currently fall under the agreement, and thereby this is a Canadian decision, as it were.
That is my understanding, yes.
Okay. So going from that, then, I'll move slightly up the list there, which is that you said that point one on your list of reasons to be concerned was any risk to radioactive nuclear waste contaminating the Great Lakes is too great. So in this case, I think that a lot of people would agree that this sort of risk, that any risk would be too great. However, I could see the counterargument to that being said that we either already have this waste or we will have this waste. So what else would you have them do with it?
Well, the situation right now is that this has been studied for many years by geologists and scientists, and the geologists and scientists themselves are not in agreement as to what the appropriate method should be for disposing of this waste. So our point is burying it within 400 meters of the Great Lakes is simply something that defies common sense. So we are saying it's not appropriate to bury this, the most dangerous poison that humans have ever created, beside the Great Lakes.
So if I could ask you to correct me if I'm wrong on that, basically what you're saying is that you're not in favor of nuclear waste anywhere. You just think that this is a particularly bad choice.
No, I'm not saying that we're not in favor of it anywhere. We are just saying that burying it exactly 400 meters from the Great Lakes is a bad choice, and in fact, we don't think it should be buried anywhere in the Great Lakes Basin.
Okay. So that being said, then, you were careful to say you're not in favor of being buried anywhere, so that very much leads to my next question, which was, could people draw a direct correlation between what you're trying to do and the anti-nuclear groups in general, or would you differentiate yourself? Is your group necessarily anti-nuclear? It's just that you're opposed to this specific placement of the dump, or would you say that your group would work, has the same sort of values and the same sort of anti-nuclear ideas as groups that more directly target nuclear policy rather than just this one dump?
No, we are completely separate from the anti-nuclear movement, from any anti-nuclear group. We are simply a group of concerned citizens, and yes, the issue that we are concerned about is responsible treatment of the nuclear waste.
Okay. Going forward from that, one of the other points you had on there was the idea that the radioactive waste remains for up to 100,000 years. You made, a very interesting point there that the Great Lakes Basin has only been there for about 12,000 years. I think you have a very, very good point to be made there that any models or ideas about, you know, sort of, well, that this would be safe seems ludicrous because we can't even be sure that the situation under which it's being buried will be stay the same for that amount of time, even if you don't get into the technology used to contain it and all these sorts of things.
Exactly. The intermediate level waste contains resins, filters, and irradiated components from within the nuclear reactor itself. This waste is highly radioactive and highly dangerous, and it does remain toxic for 100,000 years. So, to us, it defies common sense to be burying it this close to the lake. No geologist or no scientist can provide us with a 100,000-year guarantee that this nuclear waste will remain safe and remain isolated down in this CGR.
Well, I would even go further than that and say that no scientist or geologist worth their salt would give you a 100,000-year guarantee on anything, or even necessarily a 100% guarantee on anything ever. There's always uncertainty in science, and that's part of the self-correcting nature of it. So, but that being said, then I think, you know, a very logical question then would be, do you have a counter proposal? Maybe not necessarily a specific other site, but is there a preferred method of dealing with it, or you're just a group that says, you know, propose another plan, we'll be happy to listen to it, but we are not accepting this plan?
That's exactly right.
Okay. Then one of the things there, I mean, point six on there was said that there were no process to look at other locations. I mean, clearly somebody, I understand what you're saying there, and I'm not seeking to contradict you, but I mean, clearly at some level somebody looked at a couple of sites. Maybe it wasn't part of an official report, and certainly what you're saying is it was never discussed at a policy level, but somebody somewhere made a decision to put it there as opposed to somewhere else. Do you have any idea at all why this site was selected?
Yes. My understanding is that the town of Kincardine approached Ontario Power Generation and indicated to them that they would be willing to house the intermediate and low-level radioactive waste in their municipality. And my understanding is that because they approached OPG, OPG said, yes, that's good, we will locate it here. So in all of this, there were something like 3,000 pages of documentation on this, and OPG's response as to why they selected this one location was contained in less than one page.
Hmm. So, I mean, obviously, people wouldn't volunteer for this sort of thing for no reason. I mean, it would seem like the sort of thing about somebody volunteering for absolutely no reason for, like, you know, experimental surgery that they don't need or something like that. So clearly there had to be some benefit to them. Why would they volunteer themselves?
Well, you're correct. Obviously, what's part and parcel of this package is jobs and money. And I will point out that to date, $10.5 million have been paid out to five municipalities that are surrounding this nuclear waste dump. And this is before approval has been received. And if the nuclear waste dump does proceed, it would be approximately $37 million that will be paid out to these five municipalities.
Do you happen to know at all? I mean, that's a very interesting point. It makes me wonder. I mean, it seems like the sort of thing that would be in violation of the law, or at the very least, if you are successful in stopping this project, would the townships have to therefore like pay this money back? Like, it seems very confusing to me, or at least very much an assumption that this will not be stopped. That money's been paid out before the deal's even been confirmed.
That's correct, and that's why we bring this up, that something just doesn't seem right, that these large amounts of money are being paid to municipalities prior to approval even having been received.
Okay. Well, I think that's about all I have for you for now, except the one closing thing I wanted to get from you was there was also a list of a timetable there on policy. If you can just maybe outline for people if they're interested in giving you some support or maybe just learning a little bit more about this issue. I know you have if you want to give the website address, but also if you could just outline before you do that as well, what sort of stage in the decision process that we're in and what sort of time remains, what sort of options people have to voice their concerns on this issue?
Right. Well, we are in the environmental assessment phase right now with public comment phase, so people can certainly put forward their comments under that process. Public hearings will probably occur late in the spring, and approval could happen in 9 months' time. So really, time is of the essence. And what I would suggest that people do is go to our website, which is at www.stopthegreatlakesnucleardump.com. We do have a petition on the website that you can just push the petition button and it will take you to that. And we are encouraging people to please get this information out to their friends, relatives, contacts through Facebook, email, or Twitter. And we are encouraging people to please sign the petition.
Okay, well, thank you so much for joining us today. We will have links up to your website and some of the information that you cited as well after the show. So if you happen to come in partway through this interview and you didn't catch all of her answers, the show itself will be posted on our website, which is greenmajority.ca, and we'll have links to the website where you can go and take a look at the information and sign that petition. For now, however, thank you very much for joining us, Beverly Fernandez with Stop the Great Lakes Nuclear Dump.
Thank you, Darren.
Thank you. Okay, so we're going to take a quick music break, and I'll be back to hear with Kevin Farmer and Leah Mazzolini. We're going to break down some of the environmental happenings of this past year, so don't go away. We'll be back in 1 minute. All right, and we're back. I'm Darren Kaster. You're listening to The Green Majority. I am joined in studio now by Kevin Farmer.
Hi, Darren.
And Leah Mazzolini.
Hi, Darren.
And we're going to do our little bit of our wrap-up of the year, and Leah's going to start us off. She's got some news items for this week for us, and then we're going to start going to some 2012 items. So take it away, Leah.
Yeah, so Environment Canada surveys Canadians on what they think about carbon tax and oil exports. Big Oil faces a $7 million water pollution suit in New Hampshire. Owner of Deepwater Horizon Rig pays $1.4 billion settlement for the massive 2010 BP disaster. German minister says never again to nuclear power. Tensions flare as Peru's indigenous people are making gas exploration a court case. And bad weather is prompting more British farmers to favor GMO use. Protesters remove the Idle No More Rail blockade in Sarnia, Ontario, over a judge's orders. And a mining pollution suit is underway in Pennsylvania. And lastly, China is to release pollution data in 74 cities. More stories and more are actually at Green Majority.
All right. Thank you very much. And yeah, as she was saying, we will have links to all those stories and a lot more. That's just some of the ones that we've selected for this week that we thought you might be interested in. Those stories will be listed directly on the website. If you want the full news roll, of course, you just add yourself to our Twitter feed, which is at Green Majority. You can also check the website for all this information, which is greenmajority.ca. And I would be very remiss if I did not mention, as usual, that our wonderful music today has been programmed by DJ Amber Waves over at Open Till Midnight blog. There is little mini reviews of each of the tracks we'll be playing today. It was put on each post for the show each week, so you can check out the names and track titles and find the websites. A lot of this stuff is indie music, so there a lot of the time it's also free to download as well, so that's a great reason to go and check it out, because you can go without, you know, going on Kazaa and getting a letter from BMI or Metallica, because they're giving it away. They're giving it away for free. You don't need to worry about the wrath of BMI on this one. However, we're going to start our news thing. Leah, I know you've got to run partway through the show today, so I'm going to let you start off with a couple of things that grabbed your attention.
Yeah, I'm actually taking this from the Guardian, and this specific topic was pretty unanimous with most media outlets in 2012, and this specific list was the top 10 wackiest environmental stories of 2012. Now, sitting at number two was U.S. geoengineers to spray sun-reflecting chemicals from balloon. Now, this experiment is supposed to be in New Mexico, and they're trying to establish the possibility of cooling the planet by dispersing sulfate aerosols. So that is, yeah, definitely a one of the topics that was, I found, that was kind of brought to light in the media in 2012. Geoengineering really wasn't a well-known topic, and then last year I found that topic kind of came into light.
And people hear a lot of time on this program and from other sources, you'll hear geoengineering and you'll hear terraforming. And I thought I'd just take this opportunity to explain what the difference is. Geoengineering is what actually happens, and terraforming is what happens when you read science fiction books. Just so that there's no confusion about that. They're the same thing. It's just the nerdy way of saying the same thing. But definitely, we did have a couple of stories recently about geoengineering that was discussed at Doha, which I know Kevin and I were going to talk a little bit more about later. And it's been a topic. There seems to be unanimous scientific support for the idea that it's a terrible idea. You know, governments want to research it, so there's funding money. Anytime you have funding money, you're going to have stuff being looked into. So there have been a number of reports. There's been quite a bit of work done on finding out what the opportunities for that is. Kevin, I don't know if you disagree, but I've never found a single source that said that this was a good idea.
Well, no, I haven't either, but I have heard many cautionary tales about from Gordon Dixon, say, who's a credible source, who argues that we're inaction on climate change is quickly bringing us to the point where we will reach a crisis whereby it will seem expedient to engage in geoengineering, because our options for slow mitigation strategies and carbon sequestration just simply won't be enough to deal with the problem. But it's a horrible idea. It's just a ridiculous idea. We're suffering the consequences of one uncontrolled experiment with Earth's environment, and we're going to answer that with several other uncontrolled experiments with Earth's environment. It's just the wisdom of that escapes me completely.
And just anecdotally, I've had a number of conversations with people over time, but a couple recently where, you know, obviously the conversation wouldn't go this way if I was speaking to someone, for instance, that was like still, you know, in the dark ages and denying climate change. But for your kind of average person who you know, accepts that it's real, but maybe doesn't have all the information, but all the details and whatever, where people have asked me, you know, okay, well, you know, you talk about this, this environment science stuff a lot, you know, and, you know, so what about this? How bad is it? Is it really, you know, whatever? And almost exclusively the end of the conversation, their result is, oh crap, I didn't think it was that bad. you know, and so there's a, I think a strong push, and this was something that I think relates a lot to 2012. We've seen, I think, the beginning of the slow death of the of climate change deniers being relevant, at least in the public discourse. The beginning of the end for that even being considered. Not that it's been considered by science for quite some time, but being at least listened to by mainstream media that has a compulsion to tell both sides of the story, regardless of how much evidence there is on either side. Putting it at a he said, she said type of thing.
Right, right.
But I think we are starting to see the beginning. I've seen a lot less of these stories. I've noticed a lot less 6 o'clock news interviewers with, you know, quote unquote, independent scientists that just happen to receive millions of dollars from Exxon or whatever. You've seen that a lot less. Would you agree?
Yeah, there does seem to be sort of a ratcheting down of the paid skeptic and the, like you say, the quote unquote independent scientist. Denying climate change, but where the media, however, is still failing utterly to communicate the specifics of the phenomenon and the urgency of the situation. We, you know, every day millions, hundreds of millions of tons of carbon go into the atmosphere, and Lindsay Lohan is front page news. You know, it's We've got an existential crisis on one hand, and we've got, you know, Kim Kardashian's latest sex tape on the other hand. It just, like, there's no sense of urgency. There's no sense of obligation on the part of the media to become educated about climate change. I don't think they're actually educated about the details, and they're doing a lousy job of communicating the specifics to the general public.
Maybe if there was only some sort of way to make some sort of like climate change sex tape, we could really get this solved very quickly. Leah, you had something else.
Well, actually, yeah. Just kind of like to segue into another topic on the list, which was actually its own topic, which was climate change study forces skeptical scientists to change minds, which was that the Earth's land is shown to have warmed by 1.5 Celsius over the past 250 years, with humans being almost entirely responsible. So that in itself is just its mm-hmm. own topic within the top 10.
Yeah,
so
and there was a lot of stuff this year. I'm remiss. I apologize. I'll try and figure out the guy's name for the website later. But there was a story this year of a Canadian educator. I don't remember where he was. I believe it was in Ontario. That was sort of outed as having misinformed students for several years. Again, I do apologize. I'm sort of remembering this, sort of half remembering this, but it was a university professor who I believe was dealing with climate science, who had essentially been caught out and been proven and forced to admit that he'd been misinforming students because of his personal ideologies on that topic, knowingly giving bad information. We also had another case where there was a couple scientists in the U.S. who were very, very prominent, actual legitimate climate scientists who were very skeptical and had sort of sided, not part of the extreme conspiracy wingnut end of it, but had sided with the sort of this, you know, this is being overblown and the science doesn't really say this. Very prominent ones, again, I apologize, the names are failing me, but who came out and said, you know what, because of this, I thought I was skeptical, so I went and did my own meta review, and I apologize. It turns out I was completely wrong. The science is completely valid. So I think that's another factor of that, is a lot of the kind of anti-climate change side of has been giving up the ghost on a lot of cases, just because the honest ones have recognized at this point that the facts are simply not on their sides, which I think to a large degree leaves just the dishonest ones.
Well, the debate has been settled by the standards of science for quite some time. We've been talking about climate change since the 70s. And the evidence for it is by any reasonable standard utterly overwhelming. There's just no room for argument. There's just no room for denial. It's a fact. And to say that the Earth has already warmed up by 1.5 degrees Celsius, is just terrifying. You know, our estimates of the impacts of climate change are really educated guesses. We don't really know what it means to destabilize the climate of an entire planet. We don't really know what that is going to result in. We're just reasonably assured that it won't be good. And we can estimate that the planet's warmed by 0.8 degrees since the Industrial Revolution, and we have set this target of 2 degrees Celsius, which we've kind of pulled out of the air, kind of in a risk assessment fashion, as opposed to a model prediction, as opposed to being sort of predicted by a model. We've done sort of a risk assessment, and we've said, you know, 2 degrees Celsius is about where we think we have a 50-50 chance of avoiding runaway climate change. So, I mean, even 50-50 to me is just too much. Like a 50-50 chance of runaway climate change.
That's a Russian roulette with only two chambers.
Exactly. Venus is a runaway climate change. And nothing, no life as we know it, not even water vapor exists on, or certainly not liquid water can't exist on the surface of Venus because it's too hot. And in fact, we've sort of pulled that number out of the air and said, you know, 2 degrees is acceptable. Even that was just a nod to the inertia on climate change that said
it's entirely possible that the limit was actually 1%. We've already crossed it, right?
Exactly.
Like, there's no way to actually know because of the 20-year lag. And that's another fact that I like to bring out a lot when I'm talking to people about climate change. There's a 20-year lag between the carbon we put in the atmosphere and the full effects of what we're doing.
Right.
And even that's somewhat of an arbitrary number, but, you know, because we can't be certain of any of that sort of stuff. But it's entirely possible that the limit was 1 degree and we're already screwed.
The thing that has always killed me is that the scientifically illiterate have always pointed out that there's uncertainty. It might not be so bad. You know, look, you can't prove what you're saying. You keep saying that there's all these uncertainties. And I would just like to turn around and say, look, that sword cuts in both directions. We are uncertain and it could be awful. It could be catastrophic. And according to National Geographic, roughly 98% of all arable land on Earth is already being used to grow crops, which means that land depends on a certain amount of rainfall occurring over a certain period. Like, you can't get it all in one day and then have drought the rest of the season and still grow crops. Like, you have to get a certain amount of rainfall distributed over a certain number of days to support those crops. And we're talking about permanently altering the patterns of precipitation on this planet. So what does that mean for all the farmland? You can't move it. There isn't any more. It just means that
What are you talking about? What about all those mountains? Mountaintops there.
Oh, the mountaintops.
I'm sure they can grow
where they're mining
corn on
coal. We can just move our farms to the tops of mountains.
So I want to get to a couple more before you've got to run away, Leah. Is there anything else there that jumped out at you?
Well, that kind of blends into also, if you remember back in July, how Greenland, its ice sheet melted at an unprecedented rate. And scientists at NASA actually admitted that they thought the satellite readings were a mistake after it showed that 97% of the surface melted over only 4 days. So it goes to show you that it can go either way with that.
Absolutely. And was there anything non-climate that jumped out at you? I know we've got a lot more stuff. I mean, we could do 17
absolutely.
Shows
we could
in
do
a row
a million
about climate stuff.
also, growing food crises. Basically, number three out of this top 10 list was growing food in the desert is the solution to the world's food crisis. And basically, they're looking to grow food elsewhere because they're running out of land, basically, is what they're saying, is that they're running out of room and they have to look at other sources and other ways how to grow food, even in places that you wouldn't even think that you could grow food.
Mm. That reminds me of something I heard earlier in the year as well, which is that I don't know if it's just the Middle East in general, but I'm pretty sure that it was specifically Saudi Arabia is home to the world's largest desalinization plants, which is basically a mechanical process or a chemical process by which you remove salt from water, thereby making seawater freshwater. Part of the problem of this, of course, is that it's an insanely energy... They can do it. You can remove salt from water, but it's an insanely energy-consuming thing of a process. Great. Like, oh, we've got lots of fresh water as long as we have unlimited energy. Oh, wait, that's what got us into this problem in the first place. So I just think it's very indicative of, you know, people who sort of talk out of one side of their mouth and, you know what the reality is on the other, in that, you know, even Saudi Arabia, one of the, you know, world's largest exporters of oil, is sort of aware of the fact that they need to be planning for the future.
Well, the other thing that gets sort of lost in that too is the notion, well, not lost in that, but the other thing that this hints at is the just the rising pressure on this planet of human impact and the demands of human society being placed on the world's resources. And you're seeing pressure for, more croplands to support more food, to support more people, and greater consumption of energy and greater consumption of habitat. All that land, you know, there's ecosystems already established everywhere on Earth. And as we reclaim these lands for our own purposes, we're extinguishing ecosystems. You just have to reach a point where you say the world can only sustain so many impacts from human activity, and you have to draw a line somewhere as to where it, you know, where we're going to stop.
Right. And so I think we're going to take a music break. We're going to play some music just for a minute. But the one point I wanted to make there was, I think I'll stop and make my first New Year's resolution for the planet, on behalf of the planet, which is that a lot of the time, people, you know, will, if you see a discussion on CNN or something like that, you'll hear, you know, people saying, you know, you're attacking capitalism or, you know, consumption or all these things. And, you know, well, how else would you do it? And what they mean is, what they're trying to say is, well, this is the best way. You know, there is no other way to do this than the way we're already doing things. I've seen lots of ideas, I think, and one of the things there that we can reference in this case was the Occupy movement, of course, which is something also that happened in 2012 that's worth mentioning. But the case there, I think, is that the those of us that think that the way things currently work are not working out, whether that means the political system, the financial system, international bodies that deal with energy or climate or any of these issues, is that there are other ideas. There despite the tongue-in-cheek way that those commentators and pundits are saying it, there are alternatives. But let's get our act together and figure out one that we all like and get behind it. Because until you're actually advocating something else, nothing will happen. So that'll be my first resolution. We'll take a music break right now. We'll be back in just a minute. This is The Green Majority, and we'll see you soon. right, and we are back. I'm Darren Kaster, your host, listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto. Also, you could be listening to us on iTunes. If you want to know how to do that and you don't, you're not proficient with iTunes, there's actually a link directly to our iTunes account off the website, which you can go and find that at greenmajority.ca. You can add us on Facebook, where we put up a lot of, that's sort of where I use for more of our entertaining content. So I like to put up amusing pictures and fun videos and stuff like that. Still some news on there, but mostly sort of the Facebook page I use for the lighter side. It should be called the lighter side of the Green Majority. The more the harder side of the Green Majority would be our Twitter feed, which is where we post links to all the directly to a constant stream of news stories, both in Canada and around the world. You can also listen to us on any one of our community stations partners across the country. We have currently 17 that I know about, although we're finding all the time more that I didn't know, which is fantastic. But if you happen to be listening to us on a station that isn't listed on our website, hey, let us know and we'll put it on the website. You can also send us an email with any comments, questions, concerns at thegreenmajority@gmail.com. We also love hearing from people suggesting topics. We do have organizations. For instance, this morning's guest, Beverly, contacted us. We're more than happy to do that, especially if there's something that we're particularly interested in. If you have a general question like, hey, do you know how this works? Hey, I'm sure I'd be interested in too. I'm very inquisitive. Send me a line. I'll figure it out for you. I'll see if I can find a guest. Or if you have a specific guest you want to hear from, you can always let us know. We're very, very happy to take suggestions. We've done that quite a bunch recently. We had a recent interview with a gentleman whose name is escaping me at the moment, but from Texas, with a group that was talking about the southern half of the Keystone Pipeline and how that was affecting citizens. In Texas, that was given to us by a email sent to us by a listener in Italy who requested that we cover that, and we managed to find a guest and get them on the air. So it does happen. I'm not just saying it. If you send us an email, we'd be very happy to follow up with you. So please do that. But speaking of Keystone, Kevin, I think that's a great place to rejoin our 2012 year in review talking about Keystone. We saw a lot of protests in 2012 regarding Keystone. It was involved a little bit, one of many, 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 many issues that was involved with the Occupy movement and Occupy Wall Street movement that happened, and now General Occupy. There's actually, I'd like to take that moment as well to recommend a Facebook group that we occasionally repost stuff from as well, which is Occupy Canada. Has some good information there. It generally focuses on politics in general, but they do post a lot of environment content. If you're only interested in the environment content, I'm pretty good about reposting that to our page, but they're worth checking out as well if you're just generally interested in politics. But it was a big year. I think the big event that happened in 2012 regarding Keystone was the punt that people gave in, President Obama gave. It was celebrated. There were some massive protests in Washington, all across the U.S. protesting Keystone, which seemed to succeed. It was heralded as a victory at the time, but many pundits after the fact were very, very quick to point out that if essentially he didn't shut down Keystone, President Obama, that is, didn't shut down Keystone. He just punted it until after the election, which, if anything, I don't know, give me your 2 cents if you think I'm wrong, but if anything, that seems to be an indication that he's definitely going to go ahead with it, because he basically didn't want to make it an election issue. And he didn't want to make it an election issue because there was so much opposition to it. Seems to me to imply that he's definitely going to go ahead with it. But I don't know. Am I misreading that, Kevin?
No, I was one of those pundits who was quick
don't
to say,
say.
Yeah, who was quick to say, you know, we're, the environmental movement was counting this as, was hailing this as a great victory. And I was saying there's... No, this hasn't been a victory at all. It's been a postponement of the inevitable. Obama felt that he needed the environmental vote for re-election, so he did not want to anger the environmentalists. He depends on them as a voting bloc, and he, like you say, he punted it until the second term. He's under phenomenal pressure to right the American economy and create jobs. You can't overstate how much pressure he's under to quote unquote fix their economy and generate new jobs in the United States. And the pipeline would do that would be a massive infrastructure project that would employ thousands of people and generate thousands of jobs. And on that front, it has to seem incredibly attractive. I think it would be hard for him to refuse it, to be honest with you. I would think he would have a hard time justifying why he's sort of leaving jobs on the table, so to speak. And meanwhile, back here in what we used to think of as Green Canada, The Harper regime has pushed through omnibus legislation that makes it entirely easy to build pipelines in Canada. They've made...
Mysterious, the coincidence.
Yeah, it just so happens. Well, Harper never met a pipeline he didn't love. And they've made changes to the Fisheries Act and the Navigable Waters Act, and they've all, and all of it seems to specifically make it easier to build pipelines across vast swaths of land. And, you know, it's encouraging to see so much activism, and certainly BC has, the government in BC, well, I'll give the government of BC a qualified nod on this topic, because they've been stalling the northern pipeline, but their argument has been that they're not getting a big enough cut, and it's so on the one hand, yeah, on the one hand they've slowed down they've prevented that pipeline from going through, but on the other hand their motives aren't really environmentally pure. But
greed preventing greed, or is that too sarcastic?
Preventing greed,
or greed stalling other greed? Yeah, so the greed of wanting the oil money is it being stalled by the greed of wanting a bigger cut of the oil money?
Well, for sure, there's environmentalists in the mix, but you know, the official reason seems to be that they're haggling. Well, okay, so they're saying that they're assuming too much of the environmental risk for too little of the financial reward. And that to me says that if you upped the financial reward, they would then shoulder the environmental risk. Whereas I would say no, that environmental risk is intolerable, and no amount of money should be able to buy you off from that. There's an election coming up in BC, though, and by all accounts, it looks like the NDP is going to win. In which case, we could probably hope for some more wholesale rejection of the pipeline project that went going to the West Coast.
Now, the repercussions of that might be that it simply goes somewhere else. But however, with all the work that's been done, I mean, it's a lot of work to plan a pipeline. There's all sorts of things that have to
project.
Be done. So that wouldn't necessarily kill it forever, but that could conceivably kill it for a considerable amount of time if they actually were forced to come up with some other route or something like that.
Well, what worries me is just how thoroughly committed Harper is to pipelines and how he's employing heavy-handed legislation to make it easier and easier to build these pipelines. He hasn't necessarily come out and said it publicly, but his actions are speaking louder than his words, even where his words are so few. And his actions indicate that he has every intention of building pipelines across Canada, and that he wants to be, well, he has said, and this is a quote, that he is determined to make Canada an energy superpower. And unfortunately, that means a fossil fuel energy superpower. So Harper's goal is clear. He wants Canada to be a major exporter of oil, even if that's dirty tar sands oil. And you know, even though he's not necessarily making these claims publicly anymore, he's proceeding with legislation, which shows really what basket he's putting his eggs in.
Anyone who listens to the show regularly knows what a huge fan of metaphor I am. So I think I've made at least three or four today already. But I think in this case, it's almost what you're saying is the idea that, you know, Harper wants to be an energy superpower, which I'm fine with. But he wants to be like the superpower in control of all VHS tapes, when what we should be doing is being a superpower in Blu-ray or something, you know.
Right.
Is like, you're good for you. Like, being an energy superpower, I think, is a fantastic idea. You're just doing it the stupidest possible way you possibly could, unless you're only in it for your own personal benefit, and then I guess it's a great plan. You know, short money over the short term makes you look good. You may get reelected one more time is what his idea. Look how rich Canada is. Look at all this money. Not realizing that you've shuffled off all of these resources, not only in the, even if you were going to be super cynical and say that, you know, the environmental consequences don't matter, it's still being done in a kind of wholesale way. I mean, we talked a lot about, I think this is a great place to segue into the kind of war on science. And we had some of those blackout speakout events and stuff like that. Was that, you know, it's foreign investment of these companies, and there was some big kerfuffle made recently about opposing a deal with for a Chinese government-owned company to purchase massive parts of the oil sands projects. This is already, some of these deals have already gone through. The Chinese government-owned companies already own significant parts of these. This would have upped it significantly. And part of what that idea was there was the sort of, to sideline that was the attack on science. So we did an interview with someone that was part of that Blackout Speakout movement. John Bennett was also on the program talking about this, which is related a lot to the Bill C-38 and Bill C-45, which undercut a lot of the Great Lakes legislation, removing a lot of the protections. You know, there was a meme making its way around talking, you know, we used to have 80 million protected lakes, now we have like 300 and something. But this general kind of war on science. But the thing that made that connection for me was that idea that one of the main attacks that was made was this idea of, you know, clamping down, and this was mostly to do with Bill C-38, but clamping down on the funding and being somewhat overly strict and basically harassment and intimidation as far as their funding sources. And that sort of started off with a letter from Natural Resources Minister Joe Oliver, who made a very public statement basically saying, you know, going right up to the line and making an equivocation of almost calling environmentalists terrorists and accusing them of foreign influence and all these things. And to which our response at the time, which is still, I think, completely valid, and I stand behind it 100%, which is, so what do you call all the oil money?
Yeah.
Right? Like, if you're going to, you can't call one, you know, foreign influence and not the other.
Yeah.
But I mean, that case was been made, and that led to a lot of other events. We recently talked to John Bennett as well, again, about Ethical Oil, which is a quote unquote community group, which is funded by oil industry. And John also pointed out when we, during that interview, that the head of the group is like a golf buddy or something like that of Stephen Harper's. They're, you know, close personal friends. But of course, it's completely community organized. Massive federal contacts and friends, but still very grassroots, obviously. And I was looking through Sierra Club's through John Bennett's blog through Sierra Club, and he was saying how he'd sort of predicted this. I went back and I checked it. He did actually have a post from January of 2012 talking about how specifically this group, Ethical Oil, was a shill, and how we could you know, a mouthpiece for the oil industry, and pointing out the connections even back then to the Harper government, and how they expected that these two things would combine in them specifically being attacked by Ethical Oil and other groups, and lo and behold, we had a CRA complaint filed against them no more than 3 weeks ago from this very group. So he's batting 100 on those predictions so far. Do you think that there was any result from that? And do you think any of the benefit came from? You know, we're getting close to the end of the show here, so I want to get to some of the positive things. Some of the positive things I think could be said was that this was, in a lot of ways, a year of activism. We had, for Canadians, a lot more than we've seen in previous years, at least the time that you and I have been covering this together. We had, there was all the Occupy stuff that had mostly to do with banking, but that flowered into something that was a lot bigger. There was Blackout Speakout. Power Shift wasn't a protest, but it was a big event that had a lot of support as well. We had the Soup Stock event here in Toronto that ended up being part of a larger movement to stop the Melancton mega quarry. That was successful. We even had that favorite story that we were covering forever with it was previous to 2012, but another example of Canadian successful activism, which was the tiny township, the dump in tiny township, and that sort of thing. So it seems like the theme for this year, and I feel like you'd agree with me on this, is that the policy is going 100 miles an hour in the wrong direction, but that on these issues anyway, but that Canadians seem to be waking up a little bit and seem to be not just waking up and being more informed, but being more willing to be active about this. And that there have been some, despite all the backfalls, there have been some significant gains this year as far as just agitating Canadians enough to actually speak up and educate themselves and say, hey, I don't agree with this.
Yeah, well, leave it to me to find the dark lining of a silver cloud. But by the same token, I would say environmentalists have been backed into a corner by the Harper regime, and increased activism is a sign of the failure of all the other mechanisms of government. And just highlights the fact that Harper, who was elected with roughly about 20% of the eligible voters, just does not represent the public in general and does not represent the prevailing sentiments of Canadians. And I saw a survey recently that asked Canadians what their top three election issues were. And of course, the first one was the economy, the second one was healthcare, and the third one was the environment. And so people are concerned about the environment. They need leadership, which we're not getting. And without leadership, you have no choice but for activism. And Harper has taken pains to shut down activism. He's launched essentially a full frontal assault on environmental groups by giving the CRA, the Canadian Revenue Agency, new powers to comb through their funding and look for any excuse to revoke their status as a charitable entity. And like you say, the mouthpiece for the Harper government accused environmentalists of being eco-terrorists and money launderers for foreign interests, and then to sick the CRA on their books looking for ways to revoke their charitable status, that just unquestionably sends a chill through the activist movement.
That doesn't sound like government. That sounds like the mob to me.
Well, it's Harper. It's Harper and his blatant disregard for democratic process. Harper just isn't a Democrat. He's a neocon. And he's got, and you can tell by the way he runs his own cabinet. It's a one-man show. We don't have an elected parliament. We have Harper. And you either toe Harper's line or you don't get, or you're a backbencher. And he's consolidated power into the PMO, and that means he's consolidated power unto himself. And Harper is a friend to big oil. He's a friend to big oil, and he sees environmentalist movements. He views them with disdain, and he views them with skepticism. Skepticism isn't strong enough of a word for what I'm trying to say, but it's the only one that occurs to me right now. He treats them as hostile entities to his agenda, and honestly, sicking the CRA on them is just so heavy handed. It just beggars belief.
As we've mentioned many times, I've liked to quote George Monbiot's piece that called the Canadian government a corrupt petro-state.
Oh, yeah.
I've said many times that I wasn't entirely convinced that wasn't slightly too strong language. I have to say in our show in conclusion, again, I want to be very, very clear. The Green Majority itself is not a political organization. We don't have any political views per se. We have views on issues. But I'm finding it very, very increasingly difficult to distance myself from agreeing with that assessment. We've seen outright dishonesty. We've seen outright lying. We've seen policies specifically designed to shut down discourse and shut down democracy. We don't have a view against, the show is not anti-conservative. We're anti this conservative government. And I think that's as far as I'm willing to go. And that's as far as we should go on that. But I feel like at this point, I have enough evidence that I can validly say that this is an anti-environment government.
Exactly.
That is anti-facts.
That's my point as well. I'm not against the
with
conservatives.
With no qualifications. I don't think it's in any way overbearing or talking too far or just being excitable. I don't think it's any of those things. I think it's simply demonstrably accurate to say that this is an anti-environment government who's anti-facts and is pro-oil, and I don't think those are arguable in any sense.
Oh no, I completely agree, and I agree with your other point. We're not a political show. I'm not actually a political entity myself. If they were coming out with sustainable policies, I would be the first person congratulating Harper on his magnificent stewardship of our environment. But instead,
or at least conceivable arguments for a differing view.
Yeah.
Right? Like there's no even like opposition view. It's just shut down discussion. This is what we're doing.
Exactly. But I mean, we're the only country to withdraw from the Kyoto Accord. Peter Kent went and, as the apologist in chief, embarrassed us royally at the last conference of the parties for the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, and Sorry, my last point escaped me. But we're running out of time anyway.
So yeah, I'm afraid we are out of time. We'll get that on there. If you think of it, we can throw it on the website afterwards. Anyway, you've been listening to 2012 wrap-up show from the Good Majority. Thank you, Kevin Farmer, for joining us today.
Thanks, Darren.
And we'll see everybody next week. Again, check out the website for all the information. If you missed anything about the show, it'll all be on the website, greenmajority.ca. That is all the time we have for whoever. I'm your host, Darren Kaster, and thanks so much for listening. We'll hear from you next week.